Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Tuesday at 5. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Every week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in NYC. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on WBAI, currently RPM Underground, a socialist radio show and podcast from members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. I am Lee Zishi, and I use she, her pronouns. And today we are going to be talking to Amin Hussein from Decolonize This Place about their anti-Columbus Day tour that happened today, this month on Indigenous Peoples Day, and their ongoing work to decolonize New York City and museums and a whole lot of other stuff. But first, we have the headlines with Jack Devine.
Yo, what's good, New York? This is Jack Devine with Revolutions Per Minute's headlines brought to you by The Thorn. Governor Cuomo has apparently told his associates that he hopes to, quote, destroy the Working Families Party as part of his push to end fusion voting. That is, if the Working Families Party hasn't already destroyed itself by endorsing Elizabeth Warren over Bernie Sanders. Noting the success of the 14th Street busway, City Council Speaker Corey Johnson said the city should consider banning cars on other major thoroughfares, such as 34th and 42nd Street. The 500 police officers Governor Cuomo ordered the MTA to hire will not be required to wear body cameras because they will work for the state and not the city. These police officers will be directed to target fare beating and homelessness in the subway system, which is a euphemistic way of saying that they will target the same poor black and brown people they always go after. Just in the past 2 weeks, 4 New Yorkers have been killed by police officers. Early voting for New Yorkers started on October 26th. This year, New Yorkers will vote on 5 ballot questions that, if approved, will amend the city charter. For more information on these ballot questions, visit thethorn.nyc. In labor news, the Chicago school teachers and staff strike for the common good continues. While SEIU workers won their contract earlier this week, they continue to stand in solidarity with Chicago's teachers. On Monday, thousands of students showed their support for the strike by packing City Hall. The next day, 9 CTU members were arrested at Sterling Bay, a real estate development that received $1.3 billion from the city of Chicago. There seems to be all the money in the world for real estate capital, but when it comes to investing in quality education, safe housing for the working class of Chicago, that money suddenly evaporates. Solidarity with all the workers of Chicago fighting for a more just city and a better world. Around the globe, a new wave of uprisings is emerging. From Lebanon to Haiti, from Catalonia to Chile, where in Santiago this past week, more than 1 million people came out of the streets to demand the resignation of their neoliberal government. Solidarity with all of these working class struggles. Now back to Lee on the critical fights being waged by Decolonize This Place.
Thanks, Jack. Our daily headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by New York City DSA Electoral Working Group covering local politics and radical activism. You can subscribe at thethorn.nyc. And thank you so much for being here. We kind of like to start off the show by giving guests just kind of a chance to introduce themselves a little bit and the organizing they do. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, who you are, Amin, and what Decolonize This Place is?
Sure. So I'm Palestinian American, and I first got involved in organizing in the city during Occupy Wall Street. And it was actually before it was called Occupy Wall Street. So that was the initial phase of thinking about organizing in the city. And it has since evolved from a set of failures and lessons learned to something called Decolonize This Place, which is a decolonial formation that includes over 50 groups. Largely POC led. and trying to kind of break out of issue silos and have a structural way of approaching things where it's not simply about one campaign or the other or from one hot topic to the other, but actually mapping out the landscape of the city and finding ways to resist and build simultaneously.
And one of those ways has been, for the last 4 years, there's been something called the Anti-Columbus Day Tour that's held on Indigenous Peoples Day, a day that New York City still doesn't recognize. We're going to dig into that a bit about what that is and, you know, how you've been transforming these museums and these spaces through organizing. So we're going to listen to some sound that comes from the Decolonize This Place YouTube page from the first Anti-Columbus Day.
Shot down, stuffed, and hauled to the museum for display. These species made their way here through the circuits of empire.
These people, who are being exhibited as examples of a long extinct primitive phase of humanity, are actually living on the land today. Why are they stranded in prehistory?
This display, which references the continuity of Israel, recounts Asian Jewish diasporic history as a way of normalizing the Israeli state claims to ancestral lands.
We're marking today as Indigenous Day. And we're recognizing that we're standing on Lenape occupied territory. And that we're here today in solidarity with the Lenape people and all Indigenous people around the world.
Respect! Remove! Rename! 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 Respect! Remove! Rename!
That was some sound from a video from Decolonize This Place on the first Anti-Columbus Day tour. When people were cheering, that was actually when kind of like a big sheet was being dragged over a statue of Theodore Roosevelt in front of the American Museum of Natural History. Amin, can you talk a little bit about the origins of this action and how it's kind of evolved over the years?
Well, part of what we were trying to do since Occupy is move from occupation to decolonization and deoccupation, and the fact that this land's already occupied. The other thing that we were trying to do is how can organizers and people who are engaged in activism or just generally engaged can begin to think about the fact that we're standing on stolen land and the fact that this country was built on the backs of enslaved people, and that those are essential parts of how we think now and how we should resist and build and what kind of coalitions and solidarity we should have that should be unconditional. That took us to the American Museum of Natural History, because in a way it exhibits all our peoples. You know, the Hall of African People, the Hall of African Mammals, the Hall of, you know, the Americas and American Mammals, all of these kind of things that were important, because what they do is that they visualize white supremacy and they visualize empire through going through the space. And the monument outside, which still exists and has been since the 70s, has been actually a point of resistance, is Roosevelt, who is responsible for the colonization of Puerto Rico and who everyone celebrates as somehow, you know, introducing an environmentally conscious thing, but predicated on taking people's land to use as public parks, right? That was the pretext. So all of these things are ways by which we can learn our city and understand it and come together on a basis of, first, there is no real struggle without standing with the people whose land was stolen, nor is there real struggle without actually standing for and with Black liberation as a foundation of any work that we do. And so that's what took us there. But it has since evolved, which was the third reason why we did it, is because it is about taking over our institutions. This is taxpayer money that's going in. It's also where students are mandated to go learn about stuff. And so what they're learning is white supremacy. And if you look at the Roosevelt statue, it's facing east, right? And the two guns that are held by the indigenous figure and the Black figure, which are based on stereotypes, are actually submissive to that project. So this is not only just about settler colonialism, but about U.S. imperialism. Now, the reason why we also decided to go to museums is because it's protected from the police. In the sense that, you know, there's a buffer between taking over. There is no buffer when you take over a street. You're faced with the NYPD. But how do you build power in advance of that? It's going through these institutions that actually allow for that kind of buffer to exist. And you could see over the course of 3 years or 4 years now, we were 1,500 people this month from many groups. And we no longer went into the museum. We went from through the park to the Met. And in that process, we've highlighted different angles of what decolonization also entails.
Yeah, I want to talk about some of those stops in a minute that this year's tour went on. But first, I just want to talk a little bit more about the demands. You know, they were rename the day, respect the ancestors, and remove the statue. Can you talk a little bit about those demands? And so far, how has the museum responded and also the city of New York, particularly to the demand of, you know, renaming Columbus Day, which we recognize and others recognize as Indigenous Peoples Day?
Yeah, I mean, so the formulation of the demands was through a lot of discussions with, you know, people who actually it concerns most, right? And then, because that's how you have to figure out how are you in solidarity with someone and not speaking for them. But I think, you know, respect the ancestors is really about reconceiving a museum or abolishing it altogether. Because the museum, at least in its original conception, is in fact a colonial tool that builds up the state, right? That's what it does. And similarly, aside from museums, universities are the same way, right? They're basically creating subjects that then serve, right? And kind of plug in. So for us, remove the monument or the statue was in fact an important gesture to the whole city that actually solidified our struggles together, that we can come around and create a concrete form of unity. That renaming the day is something that over 20 states or cities have done so far, and yet we have not. So we have Columbus Circle, we have Columbus Monument, we have all of these things over and over again. And somehow the mayor, or, you know, I mean, it's a settler colonial project, and that's not an event, it's an ongoing project. But somehow the mayor seems to think that in order to be in solidarity with Italian Americans, that somehow these monuments altogether need to remain, and we need to continue to name this day Columbus Day. But here's the point that I think is useful. These demands are meant to communicate broader imaginaries, right? So demands can both reject something, but also point to what's possible or what is being called for. And I think that demands don't necessarily have to be reasonable. In fact, they're most useful when they're not, when power perceives them as not reasonable, right? Because then you're getting structurally at something.
Yeah, and I mean, as somebody who's, you know, a quarter Italian, I think I don't understand people's argument of like wanting to hold up someone who's like a rapist and a murderer, and you know, as like my heritage. I mean, there's a million things that would be much, much better to celebrate. But so this year, you know, in the past, you've gone around kind of, you know, as we heard in this clip, you know, reframed and brought a lot of truth and power to what, you know, the truth is behind a lot of these objects or the way things are framed actually in the museum. But this year, the tour went from the American Museum of Natural History to the Met. And can you talk about some of the stops along the way of this year's tour and how they relate to a lot of current struggles around housing, around police violence, right? Things that you're also working on outside of the museums.
Once you understand what Decolonize This Place is trying to do, then you realize what's happening, for example, at the Whitney versus what's happening at the Met or Indigenous Peoples Day is really all part of our way of building solidarity, deepen solidarity and build it across struggles in a way that doesn't essentialize any specific struggle. So starting off at the Museum of Natural History has 3 years of history behind it and pedagogy that is enacted, that you start with Indigenous people speaking. And what was amazing about that is that we've had many organizing meetings about what does it mean for Indigenous people and Black folks to be in solidarity. Because if you look at, like, Indigenous sovereignty is about the land, whereas Black liberation has largely been at least kind of offhandedly saying 40 acres and a mule, which is where's mine, right? So their intention. So in organizing spaces, what does that look like? In a collective liberation process, what does that look like? And what we said is that we don't need to resolve all this, but on Indigenous Peoples Day, let's put front and center Indigenous people and actually acknowledge the land that we're standing on and the Lenape, but then move through the city. And move where? Move to Seneca Village, which was the first predominantly Black-owned homes that were actually eradicated through the use for the first time by this city of eminent domain, right? And you can go right now to Central Park and you'll see a little sign, and that's all there is. And in fact, they put up a monument just recently, about a week ago, to celebrate this, but 20-30 blocks upward, right? From not the site of where Seneca Village was. So that stop there was no new jails. Because we're talking about abolition, and I think what people don't realize is decolonization necessitates abolition. And if you want to quote people like Fred Moten, their articulation of abolition isn't an abolition of jails. It's an abolition of a society that actually needs jails. And those are the two projects that are really important. So that was the move. That was the first stop in speaking around Seneca Village and speaking about how, like, what happened to the Black families that used to be there, who actually came out of enslavement and became owners of land, to then the Great Lawn, where we could see the new technology of skyscrapers that actually they're so high that they move. And that's part of what rich people enjoy, right? So the wind, it can go higher and it can be slimmer, and the wind moves them, but this technology allows for this thing to happen. And we talked about housing. You know, and from there we went to what is otherwise known as Cleopatra's Needle, which is this huge monument that was, you know, in a way indirectly looted from Egypt. And there's only three of them there, and they're genuinely a sign of empire because the other two are in Paris and in London. And the U.S. felt like they needed one too because they were on ascension. And from there we ended up at the Met because we figured it is the most... it's the wealthiest with the most stolen shit from everywhere. So why not upset rich people? And that's the anti-capitalist dimension of the work.
Yeah, and so, you know, moving on from the, you know, anti-Columbus Day tour, and, you know, there's been a lot of different museums that you have focused on or kind of targeted specifically on who has control of these museums. Can you talk a little bit about like the choice to focus around this and, you know, the different power structures that are at play here? You know, if rich people are able to curate and determine culture and art and history, you know, just why use that as a focus point of organizing?
Precisely because of what you said. I mean, you know, you have wealthy people that steal from all of us, and then they get a tax deduction to give it to a museum where they can have a sip on cocktails and, you know, take their debt, take their date or whatever. But it's also how they make themselves look better in society. So this is what we refer to as art washing. Well, it raises the question of why do these institutions require philanthropy? Is philanthropy really a thing when the people that are giving are the people that are stealing? We're interested in these questions because I think part of what decolonization is unsettling. It's unsettling all of this. I also think that we're closer to wealth and rich people who are, most of their money is questionable. If you go to a museum versus, you know, going to the BlackRock where Fink exists. And I think the question that we all have to ask ourselves is like, is this the place that we really want to live? Fink being on the board of the NYU and on the board of trustees of NYU and the board of trustees of MoMA? Why? What do they know about art? What do they care? Straight, white, rich, hedge fund people who don't give a shit how they make their money. You know, and I think that we need to, you know, resistance is important, but I think that what people also don't realize is ineffective resistance props up the status quo. So we need to kind of sit with ourselves and say, we're doing what other people have done or what we continue to do, and it hasn't been effective. So how can we be more effective? We don't know if we've been effective or not, but we choose to go after and try new things. And I think that what the museum offers is a different angle to a story.
Yeah, and one, you know, maybe you can call it success. It depends kind of on your metrics and how you're determining this. But can you talk a little bit about who Warren Kanders is and how you were able to successfully get him to resign from the Whitney Board of Trustees?
Yeah, I mean, I think Warren Kanders is the owner, the predominant owner of Safari Land that makes a lot of things, including tear gas, but also, you know, what is otherwise illegal types of bullets that are used. And I'm speaking globally, you know. They also make vests and they make mace and they make all sorts of stuff. And so they're a provider for the NYPD. Their stuff was used in Ferguson and it was used in Palestine. And I think that part of why, I mean, what was really important about the Whitney, and we can't forget this, is that the people that worked there organized first, right? And I think that that's substantial and people often forget that. That was an invitation for the rest of us to say, A, how can we be in solidarity with these people? And B, let's recognize that they put their jobs on the line. And I think when you get a call, it's important to respond to it. And I think that's how we imagine that to be. Now, the other thing is like, it was never about Kanders per se, but here's a strategic opportunity. And here's a person that actually, similar to the American Museum of Natural History, his ownership of these things map out our struggles. And that's why we created 9 weeks. So we started from tear gas, ended up at decolonization, but also ended up from the museum to his home. And that's important. And so these are the modes by which we're both trying to engage with power and challenge it, but also trying to build together and learn how to move. And the third dimension that was really important to what we did is that we invited groups to take on days or weeks, and they centered their struggles. Right. So over time, we deepen the kind of coalition that we have without bringing people in a room and say, what are we for and what are we against?
Yeah, and I mean, another thing the Whitney has allowed, though, is a pipeline right through the bottom of their basement to bring gas into the city. But, you know, there's these people like Kanders, like Larry Fink, who's the CEO of BlackRock. Like last week, the Wall Street Journal ran this article, which actually specifically named Decolonize This Place and kind of defended, you know, the virtues of Larry Fink. You know, BlackRock is the number one funder of fossil fuels or one of the top funders. They fund private prisons. I mean, just if there's a horrible thing out there, you know, BlackRock's behind it. We hear the same kind of thing, though, you know, from people who like defend somebody like Jamie Dimon, who's, you know, the CEO of Chase, who, you know, they raise all this money for Democrats. You know, a lot of times these people who are in power, you know, like, you know, would consider themselves on like the good side of the spectrum and kind of, you know, you're saying too, you brought up, you know, your demands before and that they should be unreasonable. How do you respond to, I mean, obviously it's the Wall Street Journal, they're there to, you know, defend Wall Street. But, you know, when like, well, these are such unreasonable demands. And if people just, you know, act nicely, you know, look, he's already doing all this great stuff. What's your kind of response to that nonsense?
I mean, on one hand, it's like, I'm glad they're paying attention. It means that we have their attention. I think we don't give a shit about what they think because, frankly, they're not our audience. I mean, we're invested in building relations. We're invested in building power. And I think that, you know, I'm more interested in the conversation, like what can emerge from, you know, people from DSA who have a lot of organizing on the ground, thinking about like, how is this happening, not a campaign, but a movement, and how they can fit in that. And I think that when you look, there's something about the way that we're organizing that doesn't separate people's histories and struggles and try to be specific and doesn't get bogged down with electoral or not. For us, that question is simple. People have different positionalities. It's not about limiting yourself to one angle. But what we can't do is think that elections are electoral politics is a strategic choice. You want to minimize harm. You want to, you know, do a lot of things that can happen that way. But ultimately, in the work that we're doing, people have to pay attention that from Indigenous Peoples Day in 2016, where there were 200 to 300 people, to a month ago where there was 1,500 people, and we took Central Park West from 79th Street, both sides, both lanes, both directions, to 85th Street. Not one arrest and cops stepping back without a permit. I think that tells us, and I think the other thing that we should look at is because all of a sudden you're not getting paid, you're not raising funds, we are not lifetime organizers. We don't separate living from doing as an artist, as an educator. I think of what I'm doing as part of my liberation and the debts that I owe. But from that process on Friday, for example, when we say we're meeting in the park because the NYPD and the mayor has decided to put more police officers in the MTA when the MTA isn't working and we keep paying for Wall Street, who's going to show up? Because we need to be able to shut the city down because they're not listening, right? And we don't have time. We don't. Like, they say close Rikers. They don't close Rikers, but they agree to open up 4 new jails. Like, politics as usual needs to stop because lives are on the line. And I think that, so in a way, F the Wall Street Journal. But I'm glad because these board of trustees, that's what they read, you know? And I know that Warren Kanders, for example, right now, it seems like, you know, he was going to bring lawsuits against people. Sure. Law is not justice. And I think that's the moment we're at. And this is not speaking like in a big way. This is just like, look at Chile. Look at Ecuador. This is our moment right now. So then the question is, yeah, the Wall Street Journal should be afraid because we know what time is it on the clock of the world. And this comes every 50 years. You know, so on the one hand, yes to, let's say, of course, Bernie is better than Trump and all of these things. Yes, absolutely. But at the end of the day, we need to operate on multiple fronts, right? And we need to make sure we center the people who are most affected by what is happening.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I wanted to talk a little bit about next is kind of some of the tactics and the organize, you know, the strategy behind the organizing. There was a a flyer that Decolonize This Place put together for the Action on Indigenous Peoples Day. And it talked about, you know, a diversity of tactics ranging from assemblies and protests to creative forms of sabotage, strikes, deoccupations, blockades, shutdowns, home visits. So could you just talk a little bit more about some of those tactics? And also, you know, as an artist, the role that art plays in all of this. I mean, obviously, when it comes to museums, trying to take back art and culture, things like that. But just some of that organizing strategy and what's behind it.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the important lessons, I think, of the work that we are doing is that there needs to be, and we need to be okay with a diversity of strategies and tactics. And if you think about the moment coming, you'll see that a moment like Ferguson isn't too far away. So, you know, perhaps there's an uprising and then, or a riot or whatever you want to call it. And in the midst of that, you know, a liquor store gets burnt down. In a way, this is something to keep in mind, is just like, what is violent? The system is violent. Then how do people kind of engage with the system or resist it? Well, they resist it in a plethora of ways. You and I can say strategically, we don't want to use violence because we want to do X, Y, and Z. Yes. But in the modes of resistance, we can't limit them. So then the question is, how do we communicate? How do we build better relations? And then how do we use our tactics to advance our strategies and being clear on what those are? For us, our strategies is how do we decenter whiteness, build power across the city, get to know our city, be both not as a negation, but an affirmation. How are we taking care of each other? How do we advance self-determination on a daily basis or in relation to each other? How do we be able to function without the police? These are modes in which we have to do. Deoccupations, creative sabotage. Creative sabotage for what? Well, all the you know, the cameras that are keeping track of us. Now, is this unheard of? No, they're doing it in Hong Kong. Right? They're doing it in Palestine. So what we're trying to usher in is like this idea of autonomy, of ways of resisting power. Because if we multiply, then it's hard for them to control us and police us. We still have to figure out how do we relate to each other and how do we take care of each other. And that has to happen simultaneously. And so these modes of the museum and how little pamphlets that we make are modes to invite people to think with us and to think together how to make this happen. And we call this training in the practice of freedom. In other words, if we were to get freedom right now, I don't know what we would do. My guess is that Detroit went through something similar, right, in the 60s, and it didn't turn out that well. And it's the same conversation right now that's happening because to me, it makes sense. NYPD out of the MTA, just period, out of the subway. But you're going to have people that look like me or like you or like you, and they're going to say, you kidding? No police in the subway? What do you think is going to happen? These are the modes by which I think what tactics we use, because see, movements usher in the society we want to live in. It's not that far. So then we need to enact the politics, and the politics isn't some grand scheme like socialism or capitalism, because all of these things get made up by people, right, in the daily interactions. So then our question to everyone and to all the groups, how are we together? What happens if you occupy a place and there's an abuser? We have to, are you going to call the police? No. So then what are we doing? Because modes of accountability, questions around disposability of people, ways of relating to each other, this is what capitalism, it robs from us. We don't know how to do it. So then our movements, our campaigns, our tactics, our strategies, everything has to keep that in mind beyond just reacting to power.
And, you know, kind of talking about these, you know, big structural systems, things like that, you know, obviously DSA, you know, our main focus is capitalism and, you know, doing organizing to build something different, anti-capitalism organizing. You know, is capitalism just like the evolution of colonialism? Or like, is decolonizing organizing the same as, can you kind of maybe like talk about that relationship between, you know, organizing against capitalism and, you know, organizing to, you know, decolonize?
Well, I think, see, any mode of trying to offer as a solution a system is inherently silencing some people that whose voices need to be heard and whose outcome may be different. So the thing about, and I'm of course for socialism versus capitalism, communism without the state, which hasn't happened perhaps, right? You know, commons, all of these things, but they're all Western. Right? That's ultimately the problem we're facing. In other words, they're all predicated on a particular relationship to property. And I'm not convinced that we can have property and change the way we behave with each other and treat the environment or treat the land. Right? So this is deep. It's epistemological. It's not just about a system. It's about how a system perceives a commodity, a resource, these kind of things. And I think that from socialism to capitalism, communism to capitalism, that relationship to property is very much a relationship to property. You get out of that when you start talking about indigenous modes of relating, right? That doesn't necessarily have human, non-human, these modes, right? Could offer, and that's why you have indigenous resurgence. That's why you have, you know, the indigenous communities in the Amazon, still in the Amazon, similar in Ecuador, and that they are leading the fight in a lot of ways because their survival depends on it. It's not simply a choice.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing that I thought of when you brought that up. I've been to a lot of different communities all across this, so-called country of America who have been fighting pipelines and seen people build really strong relationships, really strong community where it didn't exist. But the place, obviously, where that, you know, far exceeded anything was Standing Rock. And the thing that was amazing, you know, like you could show up and be there and have no money. You know, it was money didn't exist actually in the camp. I mean, I know there was like funds coming in and stuff like that, but it was actually like community taking care of each other. It was a completely, and also the fact that it was, you know, based in prayer and all those things was completely different, I think, than any other kind of fossil fuel resistance I've seen, you know, and I've seen some really beautiful organizing, but this was just something that was completely different. And even kind of going through this process of just like understanding all the ways that my own mind has been colonized, the way I talk about things, you know, like, oh, well, I'm fighting in Pennsylvania and you're fighting in New York, you know, there's, I think, a lot of growth there that needs to happen. And I was wondering if you kind of had thoughts about, you know, how people who have been, you know, organizing against capitalism, you know, do we need to be doing more to focus what we're doing on decolonizing? And how do we do that? Is it a lot of like a language problem, or are you saying like as this kind of the basis of it, is it a system that still, you know, values things like property that maybe are completely incompatible with decolonization?
Yeah. You know, I think there's a bottom line. I think there's a hesitation with indigenous, black and other POC working. And I don't mean to kind of pit it around identity, but I think that there, and this is somewhat generalizing, but the notion of like, are we willing to take this to its logical conclusion? And you can see it in even building around, let's say, a campaign around a museum. Some people say, well, if you get this demand, then the museum will get abolished. So people don't want something to go away. They just want theirs. and so they want things to remain the way they are, but better. And I think that what that does is that it doesn't recognize the debts that we owe each other. Again, this is why this is so important. In other words, it's not just debts that we have to banks in which we say those are illegitimate and therefore, right? And in that sense, we're all on the same page. It's the debts that we owe to each other, which we otherwise refer to them as privilege, right? How do we recognize those in our organizing? How do we recognize those? And being anti-capitalist doesn't address them, and they need to, right? So how do we operate in like again, kind of horizontally and vertically simultaneously. Saying anti-capitalism doesn't really get it. I'm anti-capitalist. Decolonization to me isn't about indigenous struggle only. Decolonization is about unsettling everything and thinking from where you are. That's all. It's not, you know, it's very much like you can take away the word decolonization and think of Audre Lorde and think of like single issues. Why? We don't live single issue lives. Okay, I go down the street, I'm moving someone who's, you know, I'm moving into a neighborhood because I can afford to, but I can't afford here, and therefore I'm moving a family out. Those are privileges that we have by virtue of how this country or how this city was created. We need to recognize them as debts, bad debts that we never pay back. But then that's a fabric for another society. Instilling it through a state apparatus does not provide, look at history, anyone freedom. It just doesn't. So then again, why do we repeat that? Now, I'm not saying, you know, we can debate, was Obama on the issue of drones better than Trump? Is that really a comparison to make? You know, that those questions are just like, to me, not meaningful. We should think, we should be driven by desire. What do we desire? And in the process of what do we desire, how do we say, here's how we can achieve them practically, right? So, I, you know, it's like I'm thinking, like, again, from the tour on Indigenous Peoples Day, you know, less than 2 or 3 weeks ago, we were very intentional of saying Indigenous struggle, through our tour, Black liberation, housing as a human right, anti-imperialism, right, and anti-capitalism. Those is not what decolonization is all over the world. Those are just us here sitting down thinking about, like, how can we be free?
And I want to talk a little bit more in a second about, you know, some of the other campaigns that Decolonize This Place is working on, or the movements you're involved with, and how people can get connected. But kind of as we're talking to this thought kind of... I feel like every year on Indigenous Peoples Day, I'm seeing more and more people post about it. And do you kind of worry that what you've been building is soon going to be kind of co-opted in the way that Pride was co-opted, right? You know, like, oh, well, now, great, I'm a politician who tweeted out hashtag Indigenous Peoples Day. Because, I mean, obviously, I want to recognize that this is because of really great organizing that you all have been doing, and that it is building something really important. But I feel like you get to that point sometimes when you're actually succeeding, maybe depending on, again, what your metrics are of success. You're like, now it's maybe you get more media attention, or, you know, the celebration that was on Randall's Island, you know, made the New York Times, these things. And do you worry about these things being co-opted, or is it just like...
Yeah, I don't. But I think, you know, again, I'm going to bring up desire. I think there's fear-driven modes of organizing, and there's desire-driven modes of organizing. If our desire was just to have a celebrated Indigenous Peoples Day, I'd be afraid. But what we desire is really kind of decolonial freedom and loving and militancy about life and these kind of things. And those haven't been achieved. The way we kind of address this concern really quickly, and the way we talk to younger generations who are organizing with us, is that movements keep moving. And I think I'm actually quoting Francis Fox Piven when saying that. Co-option is always a thing. In fact, that's what you want, because you're trying to move the needle, right? So movements, what is otherwise like not accepted or illegitimate or somehow unreasonable, becomes a position that now people can move on, or they're forced to move on, and then you move, right?
And so you've brought up more police in the MTA a few times. You know, obviously this is... I think, you know, been a problem for a while, but also something that's been escalating as Governor Cuomo has, you know, put more and more resources into this. And now, too, that everybody has cell phones, we're probably just seeing more of the videos and the things that have been happening to, you know, Black and brown communities, poor communities for a very long time. Can you talk a little bit about the organizing that Decolonize This Place is doing around this? I know there's an action happening on Friday. Like, how can people connect to this work?
One of the things that we kind of, you know, we don't have a lot of meetings together because we created relations of trust. And I think as an organizer, you probably would agree, most organizing doesn't happen in the organizing room. It happens through friendships. It happens informally over coffee, over tea, over one person telling another. So over the course of 3 or 4 years, and I think, you know, it extends beyond that, but in terms of this form, this mode of analysis, I think that we've been building this kind of power to now not be reactionary about things. And I think that what's happening in the MTA, we've for a while thought it's just like, I mean, just think about it. How hard do people work in this city? And then when the MTA doesn't show up for a half hour or an hour, even though it's supposed to be on time all the time, it's just, you know, people are losing time with their family, with their children, with their loved ones. They lose their jobs. They take, you know, they wait for the bus, all of these things. This is a direct line to people's livelihood. So I think in those modes, the MTA is significant. Now, the question is, honestly, nothing. Sometimes you just have to have your finger on the pulse and people are fed up. It's also could be related to Chile. And the fact that, you know, the MTA, you know, the fares over there were, they were supposed to go up and people just lost their shit. I mean, in Lebanon, it was literally attacks on WhatsApp messages that brought people out. So I think, like, what are the reasons that make people, ordinary people who don't consider themselves organizers, say enough? That's really the question. And I think the organizing, it's not just Decolonize This Place, it's NYC Shut It Down, it's Take Back the Bronx, it's Brooklyn Anti-Gentrification. And all of these people who work in their own communities and neighborhoods sharing an analysis, right? And the analysis is very material, in which whether you want to call it anti-capitalist or organizers don't talk like that. It's just like, politician, move aside. Because Jemani Williams better not show up. Because there are rats on the ship and they're selling us out. Right. And I think we've reached a point where we have a sufficient power, and you see it because No New Jails as a campaign showed who's on whose side here. These are cumulative, right? And in a way, if you look at Occupy, which was around class, and you look at Black Lives Matter, which was about like racism and the legacies of enslavement, and you look at like Me Too, and you look at Standing Rock. These are both ruptures in time and modes of relating for a movement yet to come, right? And I think that we're on the cusp of that. And I think, again, I think I'm quoting Francis Fox Piven, but for movements to mature, it generally takes about 10 years. And if you think 2010, 2011, 2011 was Occupy, we've been talking the moments near. So is it going to be the MTA? Is it going to be someone getting stopped in the Bronx for like a seatbelt and then they just kill them? Honestly, like it's happening all the time, but it's not, that doesn't diminish the fact that it takes one thing that breaks camel's back.
Yeah, I feel, I guess I feel this every summer, like that now, like that summer's now, I'm like, oh, do we really survive another summer work? So I was filming a documentary. I worked on the Obama campaign in 2012, was, you know, I think in a very different mindset and understanding of the world at the time. And so I kind of wanted to go back and talk to my volunteers and understand certain things. And a lot of my question was like about the pace of change. A lot of my organizing is around climate change, right? Where we don't have time for change. And then thinking about other struggles, like, well, you know, Black and brown people have been murdered, being murdered for decades and decades and decades. Like that, there was no time for change then. And, you know, just, and I was looking at some of that footage from the summer, I guess it was either 2015 or 2016, where, you know, there was just a lot of people being murdered by police and feeling like this was that moment that was going to get push us over. But here we are a couple years later. I don't know. I mean, is it?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I think that, what can I tell you? I think that the moments happen, right? I can tell you from our Instagram account that the moment's close. I can tell you from the conversations in Algeria that we've had and the conversations in Palestine. With the Zapatistas, if you are talking to people, the urgency is there. But also, I think that the way we're organizing has changed. Again, I don't think, if you look at us as DTP as an example, you'll say, oh my God, there's this campaign and this campaign and this campaign. And what we tell people is, no, we just have an analysis. And having an analysis is better than having nothing. Because at least you're not reacting to situations. And so police brutality is related to, you know, modern day slave patrols that are relating to kind of centrality of private property to the U.S. as a thing. That is related to a settler colonial project that actually is taking people's land and genociding a certain people and then bringing in other people to do the labor. And in the process of them doing the labor, other people feel like they're better off and they're not, you know. But we all have debt and we all can't pay our healthcare bills. And you know, so there's a way by which dispossessed people have to find a way to rise up. But in the demand, they don't essentialize and believe that unity is the move. Togetherness is the move, right? And you saw that during Occupy. People said, what are your demands? The most significant thing that Occupy did was not make one demand because it allowed for a movement to be born, which has produced things like Bernie or has impacted conversations around debt. It's all coming from Occupy. Now, did Occupy fail? It had its failure and its successes. We're not lamenting this. But people move on and learn. So then the question is, now we're better equipped. In our organizing, we have generations. We've insisted on having generations. We have people that are 17, 18 years old in our organizing. We don't meet in meetings because meetings end up being toxic. We just try to see, is there energy behind something and are we moving? Now, Obama, Bernie, those things come and go, right? But what we can't, again, I said this before, but what we can't do is say, oh, one person's going to save us. This is not true.
And that was one thing I did like about Bernie. He's like, this isn't me, it's us, you know, where I felt like Obama, you know, my understanding of grassroots has very much changed. And it was actually like Zephyr Teachout when I said something about Obama being grassroots. She's like, that wasn't grassroots. People didn't have actual power. But, you know, people were talking to their neighbors, building community in a different way, and then seeing none of that actually used to get anything done, whether that's like whether Obama didn't want those things done, you know, is a whole other episode. Is there anything, you know, we haven't talked about that you'd like to talk about before we close out, or ways that people can get connected and get involved if they're not already involved?
I mean, I think that to get involved, our Instagram is a really good place, just because we find ways to communicate with people even when the thing shouldn't be said, right? So we have plans for this Friday, and even though we're inviting everyone, you know, that's not really where we're going to remain. And that's just Decolonize This Place handle on Instagram. The other thing I'll say is that we have to find, you know, we have to find modes of being engaged in our lives that recognizes that we're both oppressors and oppressed. It's really important. And once we start doing that, we locate agency within ourselves. And when the moment it becomes mass, it's important to kind of push things on all cylinders. And because here's what happened in May 68. When power reacted, you ended up with neoliberalism. So there's a cost to losing. And at the end of the day, the argument, this is what we heard from the Zapatistas. the argument that, like, well, this is Earth and we're all here, and if it goes, we all go. It's not true. The closer of the borders, sovereign nations who have more power than others, or leaving Flint without water or Detroit, half of this population is going to let die and the other half is going to live. And that's how they're going to deal with climate. And so we, you know, and this is what's happening to the Syrian refugees when you allow them to die. And here's what's happening to the people in Libya. That's how they're going to solve the climate crisis. So it's not like we're all in it, you know, and I think it's important and to think of borders in that way.
Yeah. And I mean, even right here in New York City, when Hurricane Sandy slammed 7 years ago, I mean, there was an amazing organizer out in the Rockaways named Aria Doe. And she's like, yeah, we all got wet in New York City. You know, Wall Street got wet, but our people in the Rockaways and NYCHA are the ones that yeah. died and drowned and all those things. So thank you so much for being here. Everybody follow Decolonize This Place on Instagram. And please share this episode. Since we are not live, we are RPM Underground. So please just share all the amazing wisdom that just got laid down today. Join the movement. This has been Lee Zishi with Revolutions Per Minute, and we'll catch you next week.